Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right. So, hey, everybody, welcome to Inside College Soccer Podcast. I'm Don Williams. I'll be your host for today. Remember, Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA. And for all of your college soccer needs, feel free to reach out to us anytime at Sports Recruiting USA. Today, I've got a very special guest, one that's near and dear to my heart because we're a contemporary. We were, Thomas is a couple of years older than me, but not much. And we grew up in the same era, but he had a very different upbringing than I had in the United States. So today's guest is Thomas Dooley, a U.S. national team player. Thomas had a 20-year career playing professionally, and now he's coaching in the Philippines. Hi, Thomas. Thank you Hello. For coming on Inside College Soccer.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me. And it's an honor to be with you and talking about football. Like I mentioned once, football, we can talk 24 hours a day. So it's amazing. I'm glad to be here and we can chat a little bit.
So Thomas, I think some American listeners, especially the younger generation that may be listening to our podcast, wanting to get into college soccer, some of the younger parents may not know your background and your history. I remember you, I think you came in about the same time as Ernie Stewart, but I remember you being maybe the first United States national team that a lot of us said, wait a minute, Germany from another country? How does this work? The United States, I think you might have been the first, if not, you were one of the first players to come to play for the United States that had not been raised in the United States. How did that all come about?
I mean, it's my dad was an American. And he was in this Germany in Rammstein. Most of the people know Rammstein, the biggest air base in Europe. And that's only 15 kilometers away from my hometown, a little village, 1,500 people live there. Right now, it's maybe 2,000. But a really nice, and I never met him. So when I was 1 year old, my brother is two. And so he had to go back to the United States. So his service in Germany was over in the army. So he went back to the States. But so he went without my mom. My mom wanted to that my mom is going with him. But she said, you know, I have two babies. I can't go right now. So why don't you go? And then, you know, call us back as soon as you find a place where we can live, because we don't want to live in a motel or an hotel.
I'm not sure if it's you need
a German passport. So that's how I got my German passport. I was actually in, we had a rule in Germany. When you're born until 74, you get automatically the citizenship of your dad. So I was actually born as an American, but I never had a passport. So that speeded up everything when they found me in Germany and say, you know, hey, this guy. And it was Jennifer Hammer. I'm thankful for life, for her. She came over, watched the game with her boyfriend from Cologne. And after the game, she said, what's this guy's name? Dooley? D-O-O-L-E-Y? That's not a German name. And then my good friend of mine, he was later my agent, one of the biggest agents in Europe or in Germany. And later on, and he said, no, his father was American, but he's a German citizen. citizenship, but his father was American. So, and she said, so maybe he could play for us. Do you think he want to play? So he called me in the morning, like 5 o'clock. He can get up, sit down. You can play for the United States if you want. Say, what? I mean, there's a whole story. It takes way too long. Like I said, 24 hours to explain everything in details. But that's how they found me. That's how they brought me into the United States. I couldn't speak a word English because I spoke German, obviously, in Germany. And then in school, we are the little state where we're the only state in Germany who has the first language, French. So I had to take French in school instead of English. So I couldn't speak any English. I went to the US, got my passport. And when I had my passport in my hand after 3 days, I flew back to Germany and I was so happy. And but I couldn't speak any word English. So that was funny. It was a lot of funny stories in that time.
So you start playing for the U.S. national team, and of course you still have your career going on in Germany, right?
Yes, yes. And there's one thing that people also understand that you know, we had Roy Wageley from England at the same time came in, Ernie Stewart, Wageley, and so he could play for four countries. So his mom was, I don't know, I don't get that right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because one, I think his grandma was from South Africa. One in the family was from England, one was from the US, and one from Germany. So he can't play for four countries. And the reason is because of sickness. You can get the sickness from your grandparents, but you can't get it from your grandparents. So that's why FIFA made a decision that you can actually, is if one of your dad, your mom and dad or your grandparents is from a country, you can play for that country.
Yeah, I didn't realize that about Roy. Yeah. Yeah, like I say, you guys, your little group was the first group where we started hearing about players coming in and playing for the United States. And so how did that work? Were you readily accepted by the US-based players? Did they look at you as outsiders? How did that interaction work at first?
It was incredible. I mean, just love all over the place. When I came, every single player at that time, they look up to me. I mean, we just won the German Bundesliga, and to Roy Wageley and to Ernie Stewart, because they spoke English. I couldn't, but they were really trying to learn and trying to talk to me and felt me welcome. The good thing was we had already two players in there who spoke a little bit German, and we had two or three coaches who spoke German. Siggy Schmidt spoke German. Timo Lipkowski spoke German. Even the force, like what was his name? Timo Lipkowski and Soskic, the goalkeeper coach. He played in Cologne as a goalkeeper. So he spoke German too. So for me, it was very easy. Paul Caligiuri spoke German because he played in Freiburg. So for me, it was so easy. I went there and I just had to speak German. So everybody wants to speak German to me. So I didn't speak a lot of English. So, and the funny thing also was we had games, you know, and we traveled, and Paul Caligiuri was always the one who was rooming with me, but we only spoke German. And I said, you know, Paul, I want to learn English. I need a roommate who can speak German, that I have to talk to him in English, at least those 10 days when we are in the camp. So that's how everything started. It was fun. No, I everybody from the federation, everybody was like welcoming me. Like I was there all the time. So Bill Nadel, for example, he couldn't speak German, but you know, he's trying to work with his hands and, you know, give me hugs and all that stuff. It was nice. And then the president or general secretary, Hank Steinbrecher, I mean, what a great guy he is. And he also, you know, because he speaks German, so he could help me a little bit when we met, and we always spoke German. That was nice. That was fun.
That's great. Yeah, you roomed with Paul Caligiuri. Yeah, I was fortunate enough. I took one of my A licenses with Paul Caligiuri, and so we got to know each other a little bit. What a great guy. What a great guy. He can talk, though, huh? He's got stories, huh?
Yeah, he got stories. We had an issue. I had an issue with him, but yeah, he can talk. He's you know, all his hands and everything, and his mind is all over the place.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So what had you noticed about the differences playing in the United States with the American players versus in Germany? Was there any stark contrast that really stood out to you, that shocked you, that made it maybe more difficult for you to begin to gel with the team, with how Americans were being coached and how they were playing?
No, not really. I mean, it was, how was it? I would say it was not the same level like it was in the Bundesliga, obviously. So there was like 60% college players or players who played in the United States. We had 20 million kids who play football, but there's no professional league. So it was actually, it was easy. And we had an outstanding coach for that group, and it was Bora Milutinovic. I mean, he knows how to, you know, develop that team to be successful. It was amazing. I learned so much from him, how he was dealing with the players, how he treated the players, and the training that he did was like, of course, it was a little bit too much. Every day, 2 hours, I'm going to be prepared for the World Cup. So I actually didn't continue my contract in Kaiserslautern. Like, my contract just ended. And the federation brought me in to stay with the team. They asked me, you want to stay? And they said, yeah, we'd love to. So I learned a little bit more about America that I always dreamed of. I learned better than the players. I can help a little bit. And speaking the language. So everything was actually fantastic for me at that time. And I was just trying to help, you know, where I can. And that was just a great experience. I don't want to miss that. But it's from the game, I could figure out that, you know, they are all like dedicated to fight and believing, you know, 100% we're going to win this game. And even if we play against a very strong team, we can. That was fantastic. I mean, in my time, it was a little bit different. You know, people were like a little bit more realistic, say, you know what, we don't have a chance, actually. But America was different. In that case, was also the unity that we had in 94 and the development to 94. You know, Desmond Armstrong, he also was a fantastic guy. I mean, can go through every single one, what great people they were. Brian Quinney and so on. They all were great guys and helping each other. And that is so important if you want to be successful. You have. I'm always trying to tell my team that we need to create a unit where everybody likes each other. And I learned that not just, let's say, from the success team. That came actually later when I thought about why did we win in Kaiserslautern, why the champion? Why did we win the UEFA Cup in Schalke? Why did we were successful here? Why didn't we were successful in Leverkusen? Why didn't we were successful here? So, and then it comes always back, you know, in the US, why were we successful in 94? Why we didn't have success in 98? And it was just amazing what kind of a team we were in 94. And that developed, Bola developed that team into, I mean, where everybody fights for each other and, you know, helping each other on the field. And it's I always try to tell my players, you know, if you're going to work, you have to go into office and you work with 20 people together. And you don't like each other. You're going at 8 o'clock when you start. You go at 7:55, you go into your office, and then you sit on your place and you be happy when it's 5 o'clock that you can go home. And you bring 100% of your quality or of the possibility that you can actually bring. But it is only 60%. So now imagine that we like each other, you know. You like me, I like you, I like the other ones, I like her, I like him. And we'll all have the same interest, football. And I want to come not at 8 o'clock, not at 7:55. I want to kind of come at 7:30 and have a coffee with you talking about football. And then when we have a little break, I'm walking over to your office talking to you. And then on Friday, when we say, you know what, hey, it's 5 more minutes, let's go have a drink together before we go on the weekend. And then you would come and would say, you know what, I can't because I have 5 forms to fill out and I have to do 50 copies of this. And then I have to maybe sign those papers. And I say, okay, good. Give me the copies. I make the 50 copies for you. And the next guy comes and let me fill out the form so that we all can go together and have a drink and have fun. So now you, from the 100% that you can actually bring, you bring maybe 90. And if you create, if you put that into your team, you will be successful. That's kind of a rule of life or a rule of football. That's what you have to need to create.
Yeah, it's a culture, isn't it? It's a team culture that, and that's, I think it was very much fostered by Bora, right? Trying to get everybody to get along, right? And to understand each other, because it was a diverse team.
Yeah. But then, diverse team. It's unbelievable. We were sitting, one little story. We were sitting on a table in a hotel, a round table with maybe 12 players. But that was before the 98 World Cup. There was Brecky and Korowski sitting on the table. There was Brian McBride, myself, Todd Ramos, and Martin Vasquez, I guess. I mean, four or five. And I was talking with Brian in German, and then they were talking in Spanish, and they were talking in Yugoslavish, and they were talking in English. And then a waitress came in and want to ask what we would like to eat. She came in, went to the first guys that talked in German. So she didn't understand. So she walked around the table to the next guy. They spoke Yugoslavish. And the next ones, they spoke Spanish. And then Brian, I remember Brian was saying, and looked at her and said, you know what? Yes, I promise you, this is a United States soccer national team. It was fantastic. That was fantastic. Yeah, it is. But it's, again, it's only football. And football will be played around the world. And that, it doesn't matter where you come from. You just have to do the job on the field.
Just have to do the job on the field. Yeah, it does come down to performance at the end. And as you said, the U.S. did a really good job in the 94 World Cup. You know, whether you bring it up or not, but I mean, you were part of that famous game where we beat Colombia, right? And then the Pablo Escobar game, right?
Yeah.
What were your thoughts when you heard about Pablo Escobar later?
Sad. I mean, you don't want that to any other person. And because of the game against us, there were like two different versions out there. And I was shocked in this thing. And I say, no, if you get into something like that, where you are also involved in this thing, in this game, and it makes you even more thinking about it all the time, or especially at that time, you know, you're thinking about it constantly. There are 8 billion people on this world, and we have almost 4 billion football fans. And football fans, they can be crazy. And when it gets like, betting and mafia and all those things involved, then it gets criminal. So that's why it's so dangerous in one way, but it is a game that everybody loves. And it was one of the saddest days that we had.
One that most of us that were alive and remember that will never forget, that whole incident. Yeah. Going from the high of beating them to hearing about this tragedy just a short time later. It left a mark on a lot of us, that's for sure. Yeah. So now, of course, as we went through, let's see, you played in the 94 World Cup, right?
Yeah.
You played in the 98 World Cup that wasn't quite, that we weren't successful in, right? We didn't do well in that 98 World Cup.
Yes, not at all.
What do you see as the differences? What was what do you think? Was it because the 94 World Cup was in the United States? Do you think that's why we did better? Do you think it was team chemistry? We at all, as fans, we were looking at this as the big jumping off point, right? Of course, MLS was beginning ready to start, and it was a big jumping off point for us. And then the disappointment of the 98 World Cup, right?
There's a reason, and I also explain that always to my team. And the one thing is that 94, we just talked about that, we were a team. In 98, we did not have a team. And the problem, in my opinion, was because every player was selfish, that nobody, I mean, I don't even want to, I cannot even talk about all these issues that we had. But the overview of everything is we were in the team. And I think one of the big problems was the Major League Soccer. And why? Because after the World Cup 94, and you know, for football in the United States with the Major League Soccer, this is incredible. I mean, the development, it's unbelievable. But at that time, the national team was split. Every player had to go to one of the cities who played in the Major League Soccer. So in New York, in Chicago, in Boston, in LA, San Francisco, Dallas, Denver, Miami, and they had to promote the game. So what did they do? They're using the players as on billboards, in TV shows, on newspapers. It's always that player in that city is always like him. And then when we got there, it was all about money and it was all about myself. Why is he in a newspaper? Why is not me? Why are you not talking to me? You're talking to them. Unbelievable. And that was another point for me to, you know, to talk to my players and tell them that if you are not in, you know, focus on the right thing, forget about the fitness, forget about the success. You will not have success. In every team, when you have that, Germany, in Russia, before they even had the first game, for me was sure that I didn't think that they're going out in the first round. But FIMA was sure that this team cannot win the World Cup or go to the final because there were so many problems before in the team, the whole team, with the coaches, with the players, players who are left behind, the players were injured, were playing. And it was just, You always have to be honest to the players. You can't lie to the players. You have to bring the team together. You cannot separate the players. It's only if you have a negative energy in your team, you cannot be successful. It's never worked. Every team who wins something, a championship or a cup or whatever that is, they are an incredible team where everybody works for each other. Everybody does all the dirty work needs to be done to get it done. And if you don't have that, you will not be successful. If you have one player in there who messes up everything, you have to take that player out, even if he's a good player. Even if it's the best player, you have to do that. Because he infects all other players, or maybe at least another one. And then a couple of weeks, another one. And then another one. Now you have four players like that. It's not going to work out. You have to make a decision. You have to say, okay, either you are with us or you're against us. If you're against us, you'll be out. And then it works.
I remember a coaching mentor of mine talking about you. If you have one player like that in your team, A, has to be somebody who's playing and you have to manage that player. But if you cannot, they have to leave. Yeah, of course. Because you're right. Yeah. They will infect the team. And I've coached many a team where one player, like you said, talks to two, talks to three, talks to four. Pretty soon you've got four or five players against the system.
Yeah, it's like a bad apple. You have a bad apple in a basket and you don't take that out, there will be another one infected and another one and another one. And after months, you can throw them all away. Right. No, you have to take that out. It's a metaphor that I'm always using. It's really the players need to understand that. You are not one who wins a championship. It's the team who wins a championship.
So we'll come back to this. I know you're with the Philippines national team now, but this isn't your first round coaching at the international level. You actually you were on staff with Jürgen, right? For the U.S. national team?
Yeah, I was, before I was in Germany, I was supposed to be sports director in Saarbrücken. And then overnight when I came, they decided, no, you have to do this. And it was 34 players and no assistant coaches, nothing, and raining and the training sessions canceled. That was a great experience for me, those 6 months or 5 months I was coaching them. It was a lot of experience. And then I got involved with Jürgen, and then was assistant coach with Jürgen. And then after that with the U-20s with Tab Ramos when we qualified for the World Cup in the U-20 World Cup in Turkey.
So I want to talk about your time just a little bit with Jürgen. and the national team, because I know myself and a lot of friends of mine were very excited that Jurgen agreed to coach the national team. And we had really high hopes. I think a lot of us had really high hopes that the United States Federation would listen to Jurgen and let him restructure the youth system and the development system in the United States and listen to him because of the experience that he had had and the success he had had in Germany, not only as a player, but also as a coach. And it never really happened. It, for most of us, it just felt like another coaching stint. We a lot of us still feel today like he was handcuffed by the Federation a little bit, wasn't allowed to just coach the way he wanted to coach. Tell us a little bit about that experience with Jurgen and, again, the lack of success that the United States ended up having under a coach.
I was only there for maybe four or five games. And Jurgen told me, he called me in the morning because we lived only 20 minutes away from each other, had very often a cup of coffee. And he called me and said, hey, we're going to meet. And I heard on that drive, I heard that he's a new coach. And I was very happy and I congratulated him. And I said, you know, it's great. I love it. I mean, the Federation asked me actually before, what do you think about Jurgen? I say, I would take him in a heartbeat. He changed football in Germany with the national team. Nobody wanted to watch the national team anymore. He came and he was really aggressive playing forward and very, very good. And it changed really. Nobody wants to watch the game anymore. And he changed it. And also the style of play from Germany. That was fantastic. And I think we have, if we would have him, then he would change the mindset also of the players. They give the players a different view and that. So then... They didn't, and then a couple of months later, they called another person from the Federation called me back again, and he said, let's meet, and we talk, and say, what do you think about Jurgen? And I said, I would take him. I said that a couple of months ago, and he did, because I knew what he can do. And when Jurgen called me in, he says, you know, I want you only for a couple of games, four, five, six games, and then we will see what we're going to do. So I was honored to work with him for the national team. I'm obviously for our national team, who doesn't want to work for that? And so I get the first contact with him on the field or in the locker room or in training with him, how he thinks. And we met because we lived only a couple of minutes away from each other. So we met many times and I could see how detailed he oriented is and how many, you know, things that he was focusing on what I never thought about it. So it was fantastic. It was a great learning experience. And he is a great motivator. He can talk to the players. But the players have to take him serious. The players have to listen what a coach says. It's somebody who is in charge of the team. It's not the player who is in charge. It's him who is in charge. And I don't know that after that, those five games, he wanted me to coach. I don't know how the details were with the Federation. You know, that was him and the Federation. I know only that he wanted me to coach the Olympic team and tab the U-20s. So he said, I want a head coach for the Olympic team who is not with the MLS and who is not with the college team because they need to look for the college guys and they need to look for the MLS guys. I need an independent who is not working with both entity, so he needs to be focusing only on football, and I want Thomas in there. And then one day when I met him again, Jurgen, and I heard in the radio that, you know, who decided to get the national team, then he was very upset. He said, because that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted you to be that and tap the U-20s. So then he called and they said, no, we can't do it. He signed already. So that was for me, it was over, but I could see that he, and in our conversations too, I could see that how much he's thinking outside the national team to make it big and to make it successful. But what happened inside, I have no idea. So I enjoyed working with him in those couple of games that I was with.
Yeah, what an educational experience that must have been for you. I'm nice. So jealous. That's fantastic.
I mean, I had a lot of coaches in my career, and you know, some coaches are excellent, some coaches are you know, not so good. But even if a coach is not so good, you learn something that you can use later on when you get into that business. And I had a list of coaches where I'm actually, when I'm done and I want to do the UEFA license, I want to go out and I want to look what's, you know, what kind of coaches did I have, just to get the memory back. And from every single one, I said, you know, what did I didn't like on that guy, and what was just excellent. So when I wrote those things down, you can't copy a coach. I mean, if you copy a coach, you will not, I will fail, or I don't know, it wouldn't be good. You need to find yourself, how you think, how you are, what kind of a person you are, how you talk to the players, and get some ideas from different coaches and implement that in your system and your, how you deal with the players and stuff. So it was great. I loved that experience with Jürgen.
I tell you, you're so spot on, Thomas, but you know, I've watched basketball coaches and I've learned from them, and I've watched baseball coaches interact with their players and learn from them. What we do as coaches is man management is a huge part of coaching, right? How we, as you talked about with Bora, man managing, how you interact with your players, how you motivate your players, because it can't always be yelling and screaming rah, rah, rah for your players. That might work for a short time, but it gets old after a while, right?
Yeah, it is. I am not a coach who's yelling at all. I said I don't have to yell to a player. First of all, in a youth program, you should never yell at the kids. In the adults,
say that again, Thomas. Jiminy Christmas. You should, I suppose you've seen some youth games here in the United States in your day, and it's crazy. Coaches yelling and screaming at children.
Yeah, I had a coach when I had my academy in California. I had a coach who, you know, and you have to be the right coach for the right age group. So I had a coach who was a very good guy and a very honest and lovable guy. And he coached the U8 or U9s. And he was loud on the field. And I walked over and said, you know, I don't like that, the way you talk, what I'm talking. You talk so loud. I said, yeah, but, you know, that's my voice. And I said, that's why I'm saying you should coach the 16, 17s, because when you tell them kids something, the 8, 9-year-old ones, they are afraid and they're going back. You don't mean it, but it's your voice that you have. You can't do that. And then you see other coaches, you know, coaching the U15, 16, but they are tactically so bad that they can do like the U9s and U8s, because also they are like very lovable, but they want to go to a higher level, and you have to find out the right coaches to the right teams. But I always told my, in the beginning of a season, I told my coaches, I don't want anybody yelling at the kid. If the kid is doing something wrong, you need to explain it to him. And if he's done the same thing again, you explain it again. And if he's not listening, you walk over and you go next to him and you talk to him, say, you know, if you don't want to play, if you don't want to do anything, then maybe sit outside and do it. But you, if somebody makes always the same mistake, there was a situation that we had at our team who won the state cup. A silver elite team won the state cup. And we traveled later on to Germany and played some good games in Germany. And I explained it once to a player that he always make that mistake. And then he made the same mistake in the game again in the first 5 minutes. And before the game, on the board, I explained it to him. That's what you always do as a defender. You can't do that. So you have to stay with that guy. And I brought him in front and explained it. Now explain me how you need to play that situation. He explained it to me very well. And then we had the game after 5 minutes. He did exactly the situation that I explained, and he did it wrong. The coach who was in charge of that team, he was freaking out. And I said, you know, just hold on a second. Don't say anything. When he walked by, I said, hey, I want to know what you were thinking at that moment. What was in your mind? Why did you step up? We talked about that yesterday. 2 days ago, when we had the game, we talked about it. An hour ago, we talked about that on the board. You explained it to me. Can you tell me what you think? And he said, nothing. And I said, at that time was a U17 or U18 team. And I said, okay, because I don't want to deal with him in the game. But I told the other coach, sometimes, you know, how they are wired. They understand, but they're making a decision when they are under stress. They're making a decision what comes first in their mind. And when they do that decision, it's too late. So you have to break that. You know, and those kind of things, and I always said, you know, I don't like yelling because you don't achieve anything. You need to explain to that player what he's doing wrong. And if he does again and again and again, with my team, I said that too. If you don't mark that guy, if you stay always like 2 yards, 4 yards behind him when he gets the ball in the box, you know, I can tell you that maybe 2-3 times. But if Michael doesn't do it, if he's staying with that guy, who do you think is playing next week? He's going to play. It's normal. You know, you need to get in the mind of them. And even as a coach, you know, you have 20 players, 24 players, every player is different. You have to treat them all kind of the same, but still a little bit different. Somebody you need to get in holding in your arms, and the next one you have to talk a little bit more in details with him. And they open up his eyes a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit louder, but yelling doesn't achieve anything, in my opinion.
It doesn't achieve anything. No, it works. That's human nature, though. I agree with you. Yelling doesn't help.
Yeah.
It doesn't help. So now you're in the Philippines now, right? You're coaching with the Philippines national team.
Yeah, but I came back. They wanted me back in May, and they told me that Thomas, you need to come back because when I started, we were like 135 or something in the rankings. So I brought them up to 111. And the same thing, if they would have listened maybe 2 times before with me, we would be under 100. So we finished with the last game with the highest rankings and the biggest success in Philippine history. We qualified for the Asian Cup. And then I didn't get a new contract. I don't know. I mean, I know why, but I don't want to get too much into it because it was also with the player. And then I left and I went to Vietnam, was a sports director in Vietnam. We won the championship in Vietnam after 20 years or 23 years. And then went to Malaysia and the team. And I said to the federation before, when they didn't want to give me a new contract, I said, you know, listen, when you do this, I give you the guarantee that this team will go down again. Because football is more than just watching the game. There are much more details that you have to be aware of. And then after 4 years, they dropped back to 134 or something like that. Same place. In 4 years, we went up. In 4 years, it went down. So, and then I had a conversation with them. They want to bring me back long term. And I said, okay, I'm going to do it. So I'm here now. We had the first tournament after 6-7 days of training. We had the first tournament qualifying for the Asian Cup. Again, then you start dreaming. I brought them to the Asian Cup in 2018. Now we bring Thomas back. He brings us over there too. But well, there are teams like Palestine, who 95 in the rankings. They're having 3 incredible forwards and, you know, leave them one time alone, they're going to score. So we didn't qualify. And then now they are struggling. They don't have the money. They don't have anything. So, and I don't even know if I want to continue over here. So it's like, you know, as much as I love it, because there's good potential there. But if they are not similar situation like what Jürgen had, I don't know. I mean, different, but similar, and that the federation didn't want to do it over here. It's the federation doesn't see what's happening in the next 2-3 months. They don't see what's happening in the next 2-3 years, what we can achieve. It's about right now, you know, and again, there's no money at the moment. And here that we had no games in the last months and the FIFA dates. If you don't play, then it doesn't work. So everything has to, you know, fall into place to make it happen. So, and that's why I don't know exactly if I'm going to stay here or maybe try to find something else.
So would you ever consider if the United States Federation asked you to take over the national team, would you ever consider that?
Of course. Of course. I mean, I tried, you know, I don't know why it's happened, but I tried with the national team. I tried with the youth teams, you know, Olympic team with the U20s, U18s. I tried in the MLS. I tried in the USL team or UFL teams on the league. And the touch to get in there to have a conversation, it's not going to happen. I don't know why. There was one in UFL, a funny thing that they say, oh, Thomas is overqualified. And I say, well, what the heck does that mean?
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Because he had to deal with AYSO. It's like, you know how often I deal with AYSO when I was in California and we had to get the fields and I did even work with AYSO for camps, like a training camp for AYSO kids. So now he's telling me, oh, he's overqualified. I have no idea what the reason is. So it didn't work out. So I don't think it's going to work out.
Oh, yeah, we would love to have you. So what are your thoughts on the MLS? What have you noticed? Because you came in, you know, when it just started, you were getting your feet wet in the United States, seeing what was going on, and then seeing where it is now. Would you say that you're happy with the progression of how it's looking, of how it's developing? Because I'll tell you as a fan, and as a coach, having watched it, it's gotten better. There was a time when players couldn't play a ball on the floor over 50, 60 yards without it skipping and bouncing into a player's foot. And it's gotten better technically, tactically. I'm not sure that it's gotten that much better. What are your thoughts on the MLS?
In the MLS, I think it's an outstanding job what they have done. How they did it in the beginning, I was a little bit skeptical, but how they did everything, it was amazing. I remember when I was there, we had only six teams, and we can be thankful for Phil Anschutz and Lamar Hunt that they didn't drop the ball, because at that time Chivas canceled. I think Tampa didn't want to continue anymore because they lost money. And then Phil Anschutz and Lamahan bought the new teams in, so that we had only two owners and six teams. I think it was, maybe the numbers are not 100% right, but the difference is huge. They had at that time maybe 5 million that you have to pay for a franchise fee, or 15 million franchise fee. And then either 5 million, I think 15 million franchise fee and 5 million to run the club. And look at now. I mean, now the franchise fee is 100 million or plus, 100 million plus. And you have to have your own stadium for Tuna before you get even a chance to be a part of it. And look how many teams we have right now. Owners are in line to get back in. At that time when we started it, there was no professional league. And look where we are now. We have, I remember one time I was in the US and I watched the World Cup. I'm not playing in the US. I don't know where the World Cup was. And they were like in halftime, the thousands and thousands of people on the street, because they came all from the clubs outside, you know, having a break. And then they, as soon as the second half started, they went back into all those restaurants and they have public viewing there. It's amazing how that. And I always remember the things that I said when I came in 92. I said, we have a generation problem. And I said, we have 20 million kids who play football, but we don't have a professional league. And if those 20 million kids stay with football, and then kids play football, we creating a football country. So, and then going back to the MLS, the next thing was when the ball dropped a little bit on the fan base, because, you know, not too many people show up anymore. The MLS did an outstanding job to bring in Beckham and all those kind of players, because now you fill up the stadium again. So, and I was thinking at that time, if they spend so much time, so much money for those big stars, they could buy maybe 5-6 great players from Europe and or in South America and let them play together, so the football would be better. But the thinking that they had was, no, we need to keep the momentum going, that the people going into the stadium, they want to see those big stars, Henri and all those guys. They want to see those stars. So what they did in the beginning with the U.S. national team placing them in the cities, in the MLS cities, now they're bringing international superstars back in those cities, and now the next level of fan base coming in and watch the game. When I played in Columbus, and it was very important, when I played in Columbus, across from my house was a guy who came over and he said, "Hey, what are you doing?" He said, "I play for Columbus Crew here." "Oh, what is that?" I said, the soccer team." "Oh, great. Hey, do you never see a soccer game? Can you give me tickets?" They said, "Yeah, I gave you, give me 5 tickets for my kids and my wife." "Okay." So I gave him 5 tickets. He watched the game. A week later, he came, "Thomas, do you know where I just came from?" "No, I bought season tickets. I love that game. That's the first time I saw it." So the whole feud to get interest in the head of the people, you know, to watch the game, understand the game a little bit better. Now with the big stars, world stars, and now you're getting back into, you know, having more talented players overseas coming over. It doesn't cost you $10, $15, $20 million. That levels a little bit higher in the league. So it's now also more interesting. Then we started with the MLS started with the academy teams, what was very important, because the most club teams, they train 3 times a week. And I remember in the beginning, the club, the development academy teams, they also trained only 3 times. And the MLS teams, they had to train 5 times a week. So when they train 5 times a week, now obviously the more you train, the better you get. So if you have good coaches, like in Germany, every coach in the youth, in the academy teams from the first, second, third division teams, they have to have a UEFA license. Now in the US, now you have to get in the MLS academy teams, good coaches who understand what they need to talk to the U14s, U16s, and U18s teams. So that all raised up the level of the MLS. So if it's the MLS already like the European League, no, it's not. That doesn't have to be at the moment. Right. You know, it's just growing and growing and growing. So it's just, I'm very pleased and very happy the way everything turned out.
Yeah, I know a lot of, I think younger coaches look at the MLS and aren't happy with the product. But you and I, as you were saying, remember a time when there was no professional league at all. And yeah, it's very difficult financially to keep a league going, especially at the start. And I think that the way that it was done was probably the right way to do it. And, yeah, and obviously it's still around. So,
yeah. And then the Phil Anschutz and Lamar Hunt, they saw that. They had that sports vision, you know, not looking about now, looking about what happened in 5 years. And I remember, because Lamar Hunt, he was our owner in Columbus Crew too. I had many conversations with him, that he also said, you know, if we don't do that, it will never be football, soccer in the United States. We have to keep it going now, otherwise it's done. So I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years from now would be the same, but they didn't. They had this vision. It's going to work. We just have to suffer a little bit right now to get it going. And talking to other friends, you know, buying a team in. And for the rich people, it's in the beginning, it's like, you know, you can write it off. It's not a big deal. They just don't believe in football. But if you have really 8 billion people in the world and almost 4 billion people, football fans, soccer fans, there must be something different. There must be a reason why that is. And if everybody plays it and the fans understand the game, you will create more fans. It's obviously. So, and it's glad that we have that in the United States now.
We're getting there. You're right. We're getting there. We're finally getting to the point where some children growing up today, their grandparents grew up playing the game. That wasn't my case. Even my father-in-law, my children's grandfather, you know, he would have rather watched, I don't know, underwater basket weaving than watch soccer. He had no understanding of it, didn't care. But now my grandchild, you know, his grandfather, me, grew up, this was the only game I ever played. That's starting to happen more and more. So people say, what will it take for the U.S. to win a World Cup? And I said, patience, time, it's a culture. It will happen eventually. I remember talking to the great Franz Hook when somebody asked him, you know, will the United States will ever win a World Cup? And he says, well, if the United States ever gets serious and decides they want to win a World Cup, nobody will be able to stop them. We have the resources here in the United States to be able to, and such a large base of players right now that I think it will get better. What's your prediction for this next World Cup for the coming up here since we're starting? Where do you think the United States will end up? Give us your best prediction.
Oh, I normally don't. I never do that. I never get predictions about game results and all that because it's a wishful thinking. If that's my principle, if you don't know what's going on in the team, how can you know what the outcome is? If the team is not really synced to each other in that kind of a unit, it will not go very well. Of course, everybody's excited to play in a World Cup, but like I said before, there are so many factors need to be in place. And from us, from the outside, we can only say, you know what? I wish they're going to go to the semifinals, quarterfinals, semifinals. And we were there almost in South Korea, Japan. When we played against Germany, we should have got the penalty. And
great run.
We could be there. So it is, and that's another phrase that I'm always using, anything is possible. Anything. Anything you put your mind to, you can do it. So and in that case, it's everything is possible. Even the winning the World Cup would be possible, but everything has to be right. The German coach, I'll never forget that. The German coach, Jogi Löw, before Brazil, he said, we have to be 100% fit, 100% fit to have a chance to win the World Cup. If we are not 100% fit, we have no chance at all. That says it all. So in one part with fitness, if the team doesn't have a good preparation or they don't do good stuff, they have no chance. If a team runs 12,000 meters in a game and you run only 10,000 meters in a game, it's almost impossible to win a game. It's not going to happen. So then it comes back. But, you know, I always remember Otto Rehhagel from Germany when he switched over to Greece. Greece didn't play in the European world any role of, you know, being a championship team. He went there, he won the championship. Remember, maybe you remember the time when Denmark won the European championship.
Yes.
Denmark didn't qualify. The players said they went on vacation because the season is over. And they got a phone call, hey, because of the war, I think in Yugoslavia, the war, we need to play the European championship. Where are you? I'm in Mallorca on the beach. Okay, come in, take the next flight, come in. They came in, they trained 2 weeks, and they won the European championship. Why? Because they were loose. They were happy.
Right.
And no, let's have fun and work our asses off. And right. Then suddenly, one thing comes into the other. So, and that's why I said, you know, I love to watch the game and watch the outcome. And then after the outcome, we can talk about what went wrong. But before, it's very difficult to say, you know, what the outcome will be.
I think that's fair. And I think that gives our audience listening to you a little better insight into how much knowledge you have. And how much experience you have that to know that it's very, very difficult to make those kinds of predictions. So Thomas, we're going to wrap this up here, and I know it's really late for you, almost midnight. But I connected with you because you recently joined our Facebook group, College Soccer Recruiting Resources. So I saw your name pop up and I thought, this can't be the Thomas Dooley. What is he doing? And I started to do a little bit of research, but you've made a couple of posts in there and we put them up, and I'm looking forward to more interactions. Any thoughts you have, Thomas, are always going to be welcome, because you know, our job as a company and my job for the past 30 years has been about education. And I think if I was into the violin, I would be trying to educate people through the violin. For me, it happens to be football. Yeah. So education, I think changes people's lives, not just college education, but what we learn post high school, right? We never stop learning, lifetime learner here. And so I've learned so much from this talk, and I really appreciate you coming on to us. How can people find you? If people want to follow you, hear what you have to say, how can people find you?
I mean, there's one thing is I like the Thomas Dooley TD5. It's my Facebook site. It's because of my regular site, the Thomas Dooley, you can have only 5,000 people. So when I already reached that, you know, some drops out, so I put another one in. So it's almost always booked. And but I have like another 2,000 waiting or more than 1,000 waiting to want to get in, but I just can't. So that's why I started to open up Thomas Dooley TD5. And there are two of them. One actually, you know, stole my site actually and pretend that it's me. So there are two different ones in there. But the latest, when I was posting something about this, you know, about what I'm explaining to the players, because I'm thinking it's about the development. I wrote a book. I didn't publish it. I wrote a book about how to become a professional soccer player. And because I was 19 when I played in the 11th division and I made it, how is that possible? So, and then I was thinking about, maybe that's something that interests people, you know, kids want to go to college, kids want to be a professional player. So, but they don't know. And I said, I know because they're doing something wrong. They're missing the point. There's something that, oh, why does my kid doesn't, you know, move up to the level? Why doesn't go into the level? And he's doing the same thing what the other one's doing, going to the camp, going to a private session here, doing this, doing that, but they're not catching up. And when you think about one thing, let's stay with a professional footballer, there may be thousands out there who have the talent to be a professional player, maybe more, maybe 10,000 in the world, there are even more, but only 1 or 2% can make it. What is the difference? And how many times you hear that, oh, this guy was actually better. I had players that I played with, they were much better than me, but they didn't make it. And I was wondering why. It's right here. And then I looked and I got a little bit more involved in all that thing. And I saw, you know, those four pillars that you have, that are the technique, the tactic, the fitness, and the mental part. It's like, yeah, mental part. You don't train that. But it's so, so important. And it was important for my career.
Don't, do we? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so important, but nobody has the time to do it. There's no coach. The coaches and I did a TD5MP.com. So I was explaining this in there, you know, give the players or the parents and players a little bit more information about things, you know, how to get started, like scouted. How do they find me? How do you have a chance when you to be one of the professional players, even if you come not coming from the biggest academy in Liverpool and Bayern Munich and so on, or maybe in college, I can get a college scholarship, but I'm not working with Chivas, with LA Galaxy, or maybe the big academy leagues. Right. How? It's everything about the performance, and how can I get my performance better? Everything is about speed. Everything is about speed. It's not just the physical speed. It's about how fast can you think? How fast can you receive the ball? Does it take 2-3 touches before you have the ball in your foot? Look at that's right. The difference between the leagues in the European league and the MLS and maybe the league here in the Philippines, because it's always like it's much, much faster. I remember once I'm watching a game in Chelsea against Bayern Munich in Singapore. And there was a couple of coaches from the Philippines there. And we were sitting there watching the game. And then before the game, they make the ball, the field wet. And I said, why do they wet the field? It's evening and it's not raining. So why do they do that? And I said, it's because it makes it faster. Because if the field is not wet, it slows the game down. But they are both in a level where every little mistake, you know, could be the final score. So they want to make it so wet that you can have a, that you have a problem to receive the ball. Or maybe it takes a little bit longer to control the ball and all that stuff. So there's so much going on in that. And that's what I was, I did some on my website at TD5 and Thomas Dooley TD5. And then I started this this landing page, and I have a free webinar where I was talking about a little bit more in details and gave them some advice. Because in the program that I'm having, it's, you know, you're talking about a method, how to do these things. And there's a structure, you know, because everything has to be structured if you want to be there, because you have to think faster. You have five keys to be successful. What are the five keys? I explained to them what the five keys are. And I explained to them why do you have to be so detailed in every single key that you need to follow. We're talking about visualization. Why? How do you visualize? When do or what do you do visualize? And then we're talking about the subconscious mind. How does it work? You know, that you are not, you can feed your subconscious mind with anything, but that doesn't decide. It takes it how it is. And you're 100% right. If you know that you can't do it, you're 100% right. You can't. 100%. But if you know that you can't do that, you are also 100% right, and you can and you will. But you have to go certain steps to make that happen. And that's we're talking about problem solving. How do you solve a problem? You know, where the focus needs to be. Mistakes, you know, how many times the player is making mistake and, you know, don't understand. So you have to break the habit that you have to stop that making that mistake. Because sometimes players making a mistake and then they're just down. I can't concentrate anymore. You can't change things in the past. Forget about it. Okay, but I can't forget about it. Okay, then you have to do certain things to break that habit that you know you can't forget about it, and you be focused on what you need to do. And if the players working on those mentality and mental part of that game, you're speeding up everything. It's not the physical speed. It's about how fast can you realize a situation? How fast can you execute it? How fast can you think you find a solution and all that stuff? And you can train that. You can train that at home. And that's what's my last post. But I had, so you know what? My best, I love to do that at home. Love to think about stuff that I'm, you know, I want to win that game. I want to score that goal. I want to goalkeeper. I want to get that ball out of the air, out the corner, whatever that is. I want to be... You know, goalkeeper has to win 3, 4, 5 games in the season. Yeah, you can't have a goalkeeper who's losing all the games. Right. You need a one who saves those. So how can you do that? What do you need to think about? And how you get those shots, how you get those in the one-on-one when they're coming at you. If you do that, you will get that into your brain and you make a much quicker decision. And that's when you'll be better on the field than other players. And again, I wrote that down in a book, but I didn't publish it. So I was thinking about, I'm doing a program, a mentorship program. That's why the TD5MP, my number five, and now it's coming back with the five keys, mentorship program. So that was my thing that I want to give back to the kids.
Well, we will support that. College Soccer Recruiting Resources and Sports Recruiting USA, we'll support that. So any posts that you want to make, we've got about 8,000 or so followers in that group. And so Thomas Dooley, TD, Thomas Dooley 5, Thomas Dooley, TD 5. Everybody look for that. Find him on Facebook. Go to his website. Thank you, Thomas. I really appreciate you coming on with us.
Thank you for having me and a nice conversation.
All right. Thank you.